are listening to the Marty Leeds Math Magical Radio Hour, where we discuss myth, math, spirituality, philosophy, and much, much more. www.thesyncbook.com. Welcome, everyone. It's Marty once again. Glad you are back for more Math Magic. Got a great show for you this evening. My guests and I, we cover a lot of ground here, so I do hope you enjoy it. A few quick notes here before we launch into the interview. I will not be posting a podcast next week and most likely the following week either. I wanted to get a Christmas show together, but due to my work schedule, leaving for home for the holidays and the like, I just plumb ran out of time. But the show will be back on the air in the new year with a whole lot of great guests lined up, and I'm really looking forward to having a great 2015. I have lined up Dr. Carmen Bolter, Daniele Bolelli, Josh Toms, Laird Scranton is going to come back on for a visit, David Metcalf, author J.S. Williams. We just got a killer lineup, and there's even more people that are in the works, so stay tuned for a great 2015. Please don't forget about checking out the Modern Knowledge Tour this next year as well. You can go and look at the lineup and the dates and all of that at modernknowledge.ca. New info and guests are being added all the time, so when you do get a chance, please go over there, check that out. Also, don't forget, I'll be speaking at the River of Stars Astrology Conference this next March in Hawaii. If you want to get possible tickets for Christmas or something like that, you can get all the info at theriveroftheriverofstars.com. I'll be giving 3 lectures there, so please check that out. And then also, don't forget about the upcoming webinars in January. It's with actually Randall Carlson, last week's guest here at the Math Magical Radio Hour. And you can check out those webinars at sacredgeometryinternational.com. I think they have 2 of them scheduled. So, yeah, go there. Check that out. It's going to be great. I have some more videos in the works as well. I'm looking at doing one on the Rubik's Cube, the Ouija board, and juggling. So look forward to more videos in the upcoming year. And just to let everybody know, I'm also about halfway through my new book, Volume 3 in the Pi and the English Alphabet series. And I hope to have the book out by next August, so before the Modern Knowledge Tour begins. And I must say, I'm really excited for this book. I think it'll probably be my best effort yet, so look forward to that. I hope everyone has a wonderful Christmas or Hanukkah or Pagan Sun Worship Day or whatever it is you celebrate. I hope everyone has a wonderful New Year. I want to thank you all for helping me make this show possible. I could not do it without you, and I just couldn't do it without the support of wonderful folks like yourself. So, alrighty, let's do this. Tonight's guests are Freemason, author and lecturer Timothy Hogan, and the musical guest is Tony DePofi. This show is brought to you by The Sync Book Radio. Check out all the wonderful podcasts. 42 Minutes, Always Record, Astro Music, Pentimental, and Synchronize. More information about Sync Book Press, Sync Book Radio, and Sync Book events can be found at www.thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, please share it with your friends and please support it by becoming a donor. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website, and please consider setting up a monthly charge as it helps us keep the lights on and helps keep our microphones humming. And as always, thank you for your support. Our guest tonight is Timothy Hogan. Timothy W. Hogan has been a student and past master within several different esoteric organizations over the last 20 years. He has studied within various branches of Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, Martinism, and Templarism, as well as other orders of both Eastern and Western lineage. He is a former editor and writer for the periodicals Lit Initiation and Ariadne's Web, and currently writes for Living Stones magazine. Tim is also the author of such works as The Alchemical Keys to Masonic Ritual and The 32 Secret Paths of Solomon, and has also written dozens of articles and delivered hundreds of lectures all around the world on different aspects of the esoteric tradition and spiritual history to both public and private venues, including lodges and grand lodges. He has appeared on television programs such as Dateline, The Today Show, and ABC Nightline, and has also appeared in Time magazine. So without further ado, let's get pious with Timothy Hogan. Timothy, welcome to the show. I'm glad we're going to get a chance to do this because I know you're a busy guy. So thanks for taking the time to speak with me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on your show.
Yeah. So I just finished your book, The Alchemical Keys to Masonic Ritual, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And my friend Dashmish, an online friend, he turned me on to one of your interviews and then one of your lectures on YouTube there. And I know there's a whole lot of things we can talk about, so this is going to be great. So
very good. Yeah, it's a short little book, but it's full of a lot of meat.
It is. It's jam packed. You know, that's what I really like about things that kind of, you know, that when you're pointing towards the truth, you don't really need to speak a lot. You know, it's like you can speak the truth in you know, just limited phrases, things like that. You can really get to the heart of it. So that's really what the book does. So I appreciate it. So, I wanted to get to your history a little bit. How did you end up coming into looking into Gnosticism, alchemy, and then making the correlations to Masonic emblems and elements of Freemasonry and that sort of thing?
Well, you know, I was very fortunate. When I first became a Mason, my grandfather, who had brought me into his lodge, which was East Denver Lodge, number 160, my grandfather, Hugh Warren, was a metallurgist at Denver University. And as I was going through the learning my proficiency of things I needed to memorize, he would take me through it, and he would also say, hey, you know, there's a tradition that a lot of this stuff relates to relates to alchemy, which is a precursor to chemistry, and he would kind of give me some examples as related to the penalties of the obligations. And then from there, that really fascinated me, so I just started picking it up and trying to study it more and more over the years. And when I got a pretty good understanding of it, that is when there was a number of television shows on the air at the time where Masonic authors or experts were saying, "Oh, there's no secrets in Freemasonry." This made me so frustrated. I felt like I needed to get something out there just to change the dialogue within the craft. And so that's the whole reason why I published the book.
So you got into Masonry from your family, it sounds, huh?
Correct, yeah. My grandfather, Hugh Warren, well, I have a long line of Freemasons. My great-grandfather was named James Baden Warren, and he was a district lecturer in Pennsylvania. And then it just keeps going back to my great-great-great-great-grandfather, General Joseph Warren, who's the one who initiated Paul Revere and who was one of the first, I think he was the first Grand Master in the forming United States. So,
really?
Yeah, it's a long family history of it. And he was also an alchemist, too, by the way. So he's known as for fighting in the Battle of Bunker Hill, but actually he was a physician and he was studying alchemy. So,
you know what? As you're saying that, since your book is about kind of like stringing these things together, whether that's Gnosticism, alchemy, that sort of thing, maybe can we get a definition of what alchemy is to you? Like, how do you define this?
Yeah, well, I define it, I think, a similar way that the Kabbalists and Gnostics would, and that's the idea that, you know, there's something precious within the heart of everything, and the goal of alchemy is to bring that forward and make it shine through removing impurities and thus causing a transformation. So in a lab standpoint, it was all about, of course, the symbolic turning lead into gold, but it was also about learning to make good medicines that could help heal the body and things of that nature. Whereas metaphorically speaking, it related to this idea that, you know, within us is this light and we have to bring it forth and we have to remove the things that are obscuring that light within us. And if we can do that, then we can be transformers of the world. So alchemy is something that can occur certainly in a lab, but also more importantly, you know, there's a spiritual alchemy within ourselves, and then there's also a social alchemy too, and that is, how do we transform our social environments into something more precious?
And you see this, basically this fundamental idea of, you know, the divine spark within everybody, bringing that forward. You see this kind of as a current that runs through Gnosticism, that runs through alchemy, that runs through Hermeticism, and then is brought forward by Masonry. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, when we're seeking that light in Masonry, we're trying to find that light within ourselves, and we're trying to bring it out into the world and become masters in transforming it. And, you know, the Gnostics taught something very similar. You know, they said, in fact, they were referred to as, many of the Gnostic sects referred to themselves as the sons of light, and also the sons of the widow, and which is something we've certainly encountered in Freemasonry as well. So, but it's all about this idea of how do we transform ourselves, and through that transform the world. And they believed that if there's something was true, I mean really true, then it occurred on all levels. It wasn't just a psychological metaphor. It wasn't just a, you know, a spiritual transformation, but it also occurred on a, or could occur on the physical plane as well. And so this is a, and of course the, a lot of these ideas of the alchemists and things that they were doing were later adopted by chemistry, which, you know, again just came from alchemistry, and it just applied more to chemical reactions and that type of thing. But to the alchemists there was this spiritual philosophy behind it.
So how much do you see, when we look at, when especially with alchemy, we have the alchemical spiritual process, but then there's also the process of actually, you know, actual chemistry going on. Masonry, you have kind of the same thing where you have the builders of masonry, but then we actually can take these elements to be symbolic as well. Do you see them as mainly metaphors, or do you see them as kind of acting on in both ways, if you know what I'm asking?
Yeah, I think it does act in both ways. I mean, it, certainly it's a metaphor. One of the greatest gifts of Freemasonry is it helps people to begin to think symbolic. And once you can begin to think symbolically, a whole new world opens to you. And you can read things, for example, sacred texts and otherwise, in a totally new light. And it becomes, that symbolism becomes the seeds for transformation within yourself. And but that doesn't mean it can't also be applied, you know, as an actual practice. You know, I know lots of Freemasons who are also operative Freemasons in the sense of, you know, they actually do build things. Same goes for alchemy. You know, some people, it is purely a symbolic exercise, but there are some who also have labs in which they, in fact, there are lodges and grand lodges all over the world that have alchemical labs in them, and where these ideas, these symbolic ideas, are also actually practiced.
So, you know, as a Mason, how much has this, you know, whether it's the emblems, the symbols, the rituals, you know, the works surrounding Freemasonry, how much has this affected your own spiritual life? I mean, is this been a deep process for you, or is this just, you know, has this been also just intellectual, or?
Yeah, a huge part, yeah. I mean, I would say probably one of the most important parts of my life. I mean, part of that too has come from when I was younger and started figuring out some of these mysteries associated with the craft. At the time, even though these mysteries are alluded to within a number of appendant bodies like the Scottish Rite, I was amazed at how many Freemasons still had no clue about them. They weren't paying attention to what is in our own ritual. And so I kind of felt at some point that I had a responsibility to begin to remind Masons of these truths so that they can start exploring them for themselves.
How much, I mean, as you're saying right now, like when you go around and you give these lectures and things like that, how much do you see that this has been lost? Like when you present this information, do you see a spark in people's eyes? Do they get this? Are they interested? Or do you feel like when, you know, that it's been mainly lost? Or do you see like a resurgence in the contemporary, you know, Masons that are joining now?
Well, there's definitely a resurgence.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that a lot of the reactions depend on where I go, both around the United States and in Europe. I would say generally outside of the United States, Freemasonry is already much more open to these ideas. They are a regular part of the Masonic discussion. So all I'm really doing is bringing maybe some new revelations related to that. Here in the United States, I think a lot of things after the Morgan affair, Freemasonry tended to start to water a lot of things down to appear less creepy and more social friendly. And then it was complicated even more by, with world wars and everything else, where people who were passing on this oral tradition, would go off to war or whatever and not come back. And so it wouldn't get passed on in their lodges. And so, so for some Masons, it's very much a new idea to them. But once they hear it, I'll tell you, I've had Masons who have been brothers who've been Masons for over 60 years come up to me after lectures and say, I learned more this lecture than in the last 60 years I've been a Mason. So that's really humbling for me, but it's great too. It's exciting,
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I had Richard Cassaro on, who wrote, he's a Mason, who wrote the book Written in Stone, and he actually gives lectures as well. And he said the same thing, that there was these brothers that were there for, 50 years or whatever. He would give a lecture on a lot of this ancient sacred architecture, and it was like it was sort of an illumination in these people's eyes, like, oh, it's like all of this stuff is kind of making sense again. So
yeah,
so that's really great that even like the older brothers are kind of getting this information as well. It's not just the new people that are joining.
Well, everybody, whether people realize it or not, if you're a Mason, you have all this information. It's in a veiled form somewhat. And so once it's pointed out to you, hey, this is, symbolically speaking, this is further what this means, it opens up this whole new world, and it makes Freemasonry more vibrant and exciting and more of a personal study and quest, and consequently more fulfilling. I think one of the most dangerous things we can do is when we hear a Mason say, oh, all this stuff doesn't mean anything, just do it, get it memorized, and hurry up so we can get you the next degree so you can attend our business meetings, if you're saying it doesn't mean anything, that means what you're telling people is, hey, this is meaningless. And if it's meaningless, then why would anyone want to do it?
Yeah.
So I think it's really important that we preserve these meanings, and we can provide that. And even if we don't feel adept in being able to teach them ourselves, at least we're aware of them to the point that we can point new brothers in the right directions to learn about them if they wish to do so.
Since you just mentioned that there's a lot of like veiled material, why do you see that this stuff has been veiled? And this is beyond, of course, Masonry. This goes into alchemy. This goes into Hermeticism. It seems like there's part of this tradition is sort of hiding, occulting, veiling this information. Why do you think that is?
I think it's twofold. One is there's certainly been persecution. Mm-hmm. People with some of this knowledge have been persecuted throughout history many times. I mean, Giordano Bruno, for example, was burnt at the stake for talking about these things. Cagliostro was thrown in prison for endorsing some of this stuff. After he got invited to the Vatican to talk about it, he was thrown in prison there. So, there has been persecution, but another part of it is, I think, part of it's about personal self-discovery. And some of these things you have to discover on your own, and that's what makes them meaningful. And part of it, too, comes down to personal responsibility. I think if you follow a lot of these sacred sciences to their logical conclusion, you realize that everything that happens to you in life on some level is because you've attracted yourself to it in order to learn something from it. And that means you are totally responsible for your own life. And most people don't want to be responsible. So
most people don't even want to hear that.
Yeah, most people don't want to hear that, you know. And so, you know, our thoughts, how we're thinking, our words, our actions, all these things leave imprints in the world that draw things to us, and good or bad. And, you know, most people just don't want to have to be responsible for that, but that's what mastery is. I mean, that's what being a master mason really is you're creating your environment, you're creating your reality, and you're creating your world around you. And you're active and conscious of what you're doing in that capacity.
I'm glad you're saying that, because to me, that's that. When I look at the word Freemason, that's what I get from it. A Mason is a person who builds. So in this sense, you're building your consciousness, you're building your spiritual life. And how are you doing it? You're doing it with your free will. And so that makes a lot of sense to me when we look at it in the spiritual context.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think there's no accident there's been so many very influential people in the world who are also Freemasons, because they understood this truth, which is really it goes back to the Hermetic principle that the alchemists studied, and certainly, and this was that, look, if there is one God and he's the creator of everything, that means there's nothing outside of himself. And the only way he could create is within his own mind. Therefore, we are all in the mind of God. Which is a very matrixy thing, you know. But the next extension to that is being conscious entities within this mind stuff. Our mind is also part of that greater consciousness we're a part of, and therefore we also have an influence on the consciousness stuff that's happening. And you know, God's probably learning as much from us as we are from him in his mind. So it's a two-way thing, and you know, it's a very metaphysical concept, but this was the basis for the realization that, look, we can create our world the way we want it to be. And since everything is mind stuff anyways, we can transform it into what it needs to be.
You know, with this free co-creating that we do, that is very powerful. And so when you were talking earlier about, you know, people that have been persecuted for this, I mean, it seems to me that the only reason that they would be persecuted is because this is powerful information. And when we look at the master alchemists, guys like Newton, you know, Athanasius Kircher, Henrik Nolius, these sorts of guys, the claim seems to exist that these guys gained a deeper understanding, a scientific understanding of the world, of the universe, directly from studying the intelligent force within creation, being the God source. And so that's what it seems to me. So it's like this metaphysical tradition seems to be the school in order to teach you how to do that. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, I would see it that way. And I would also say that part of the reason why this is a threat to any religious authority, I'm not going to point out any particular religion, but you know, the fact of the matter is, if you have a direct connection with God, with the mind of God, and the mind of God is in you, that means you don't need someone to pray for you in order to get you into heaven, right?
Yeah.
It means you're your own conduit, and most religions are based on being, you know, setting themselves up as an intermediary between people and God, and they profit off of that. And so, you know, this suggests, you know what, you have that direct connection, and God's with you all the time. And you know, we're told in the third degree, right before there's this journey of Hiram, it says, you know, before you had someone to pray for you, now you do not. You must pray for yourself. And this is a very profound idea, you know.
It is. I mean, do you see that most of the religions have kind of taken this angle? I mean, do you feel like the because I don't see it this way, that the religions were created for the express intent of being that conduit, but actually the tradition was originally to tell you how to do it yourself. But it seems that we've strayed away from that with the organized religions. That seems to be the case. Is that what you see as well?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't want to bash religions. I think
absolutely.
Religions can be a beautiful way to come to that self-realization. I think that's part of their purpose. But originally, at the start of all religions, I think that's the purpose. But what happens is when the symbolic elements that are there to design you, just to help you achieve that personal revelation, then start to become a dogma that's not even understood by the religious leaders sometimes themselves. Mm-hmm. It can become set up as a social institution, that this is just what you do. Nobody really necessarily questions what they're doing or why they're doing it or why these elements are being used in the ritual. And Freemasonry can be guilty of that too, So it's just it's not the fault of the religious establishments, I think. It's the fault of human nature in thinking too small,
That's such an important point, because it's like the persecution that we see comes from not the religions, but the people acting on behalf of the religions, right?
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I would say, I've met what I feel are great mystics and great masters, sometimes great alchemists in all kinds of different religions. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's not, it's not confined to, a particular religion. It's not the religion's fault. It's the lack of bigger perspective of some of the people who are in it. And that's just human nature, and that's okay. So
it's what happens, right?
That's what happens. But that's why this social transformation is so important, this alchemical social transformation. And consequently, there have been eras in history where we've had more Renaissance thinking, and there's been other times where, we haven't. It's been the opposite, So it's just what people go through.
Do you feel like right now is one of those times that we haven't, if you will? But it also seems like there's a reemergence, that there's a spring or something, if you will, blooming happening with this ancient information, that it seems to be coming back.
I think so. I mean, geez, when I first started talking about alchemy and masonry, you would have thought I was doing something really bad in the craft or something. Really, it kind of upset some people. You know what I mean? But
really?
Yeah, but now it's like pretty common. I mean, you find Masons all over the United States talking about it and, sharing and doing things. And so I think there is a renaissance that's happening right now. And I think it's become more socially accepted. I think that people just had such a weird stigma of what alchemy was, and they think of it as witchcraft or something, crazy like that, when it's really not, it's really not that at all. It's just about how do we connect the individual minds with the great mind in order to bring about transformation.
So this stigma of calling, things like alchemy or hermeticism witchcraft or paganism witchcraft, I mean, that seems to be something that's been leveled at the Freemasons as well. Have you gotten a lot of that, giving lectures and things like that?
There have been some areas that I've gone to, some territories where they were really uncomfortable what I was going to be talking on. And then when I started pointing out all of the alchemical stuff in the Bible, for example, then all of a sudden it was okay, So, I've never left a place with people feeling uncomfortable with it. I've walked into places with people feeling uncomfortable, and then by the time I was done, they were like super excited about it, So, mm-hmm.
Well, that's one of the prerequisites of joining Masonry is kind of well, it's you have to believe in higher power. Is that correct? It doesn't matter what higher power it is, but you have to believe in God. Correct.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, from a hermetic and alchemical, Kabbalistic standpoint, Gnostic standpoint, and I would say a Masonic standpoint. I mean, there has to be a higher power, otherwise. Nothing we're doing here has any meaning. And if you're building a system based on symbolic meaning, better be some order to it. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. And I think a lot of the early mystics, earliest philosophers, I mean, Pythagoras certainly, who coined the term philosophy, believed that, look, we see order throughout all of nature. We see mathematical patterns showing up and everything else, and this is proof that there has to be a mind behind creation, and that's where you have to start from. Mm-hmm.
And that mind behind creation, that is, it's non, you know, sectarian. It's beyond all divisions, right? I mean, that's the whole idea of oneness. I remember in one of your lectures, you spoke about the fact that in one of the, I think it's a Knights Templar cathedrals, you have these, you know, a bunch of these awakened or enlightened priests, and they were buried next to each other, and their tombstones were in different languages. So it was like it was different faiths that were celebrated there, which you know, it makes you come to the conclusion that these people recognized there was something beyond the particularities of each religion, that there was something divine within man. And that, of course, would make sense if we understood the oneness of God, right?
Absolutely. You know, I think that, there was this understanding that, look, I mean, there's the outward expression of spirituality, which is usually colored by the cultural,
many different flavors,
region, that of which it came forth. But at the root of it all, we're talking about the same thing. You know, we're talking about getting to the same place, and you may have this expression of it, and I may have this other expression of it, but the initiate recognizes that, look, we're talking about the same thing here. You may use a different language, a different word, but it's the same thing. I mean, the example I love to use on that is, you know, in Revelations, it says, to he who overcometh will be given the hidden manna and the white stone. Mm-hmm. And within Tibetan Buddhism, basically says the same thing. To he who overcometh will be given the hidden mani and the precious white stone. And both represent the stone of enlightenment. And so, you know, it's the same thing. It's just maybe colored a little differently by the culture of where it's coming from. But it's all dealing with the, how do we get back to that oneness, and how do we get back to that mind stuff of God?
What is the symbolism of, when we look at the Philosopher's Stone, we look at the, you know, as the, what you just said, the white stone and the manna. What is the symbolism of that stone mean to you?
To me, the Philosopher's Stone has several layers of meaning, just like there's, you know, you can have a, you know, a physical, a psychological, you know, a spiritual aspect of the same thing. But to me, the Philosopher's Stone, from a physical standpoint, it's said to be a thing that does transmute metals and raises the consciousness and heals the body, which is pretty straightforward. If you're able to do all that, you're pretty much going to master your physical reality, right? From a philosophical standpoint, it, you know, represents that which takes something mundane and turns it precious. And as Masons, we may look at it like this. I mean, when we open a lodge, you know, we're creating this sacred environment. When in reality, all we're sitting in is some room that could be anywhere. It could be any type of room, but we're defining it as something special and sacred. And consequently, we're getting a transformative experience out of that based on how we're defining it.
Just by the conscious recognition of what you're doing, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, think of, I mean, I've been in lodges. I've been in lodges in some very interesting places around the world. You know, some of them weren't exactly, you know, big elaborate lodges. You know, they were hidden, little hidden things behind a bookcase somewhere. But because of how the people were defining the space in there, and were devoting themselves to this transformational art, you know, it became a transformative place, and it became sacred. And so, go ahead.
This seems to be key within the whole concept to me, because when you go, it's because no one's going to petition you to be a Mason. You have to petition the Masons to be one yourself, which basically points to the fact that you have, it's self-directed will, that you have to make the conscious decision that you are going to go on that path of spiritual recognition, spiritual awakening, which is, you know, basically what we're talking about when we talk about the conscious, you know, ascension of the stone, if you will, right?
Yeah, I mean, we're defining our reality. I mean, that's really, in my opinion, what the lost word represents. I mean, our ability to define our reality. And people define things all the time without realizing it. But we find metaphors of this related to, for example, in the Garden of Eden, God gave Adam and Eve the power to name things. When we name something, we're defining our relationship to it. Mm-hmm. So when we take this room, which say it's a warehouse room, and all of a sudden we define it as a lodge, you know, we're going to do work in there. We are defining it as something sacred at that moment. And we're changing our relationship to the space. Mm-hmm. And it becomes more transformative. Or you see this all the time in media where people will rename things in order to feel more empowered by it.
Yeah.
You know, for example, you know, there used to be this word that you'd see in commercials called impotence, and later it'd be called erectile dysfunction, and now it's called ED. All they're doing is redefining it, the name, in order to redefine people's relationship to it so they feel more empowered, you know. Uh-huh. And that happens in advertising all the time, you know. But when we do that with our reality, we create a more fulfilling reality for ourselves.
Yeah. When, since we're kind of talking, we're hitting on this, like, you know, the enlightening or self-awakening process, you talk about it, this psychological ascension process, represented in the levels of the substantiation of matter, the four elements being earth, air, water, and fire. Can you talk about this? Can you flesh this out a little bit and how it's correlated through, you know, alchemy and Freemasonry?
Sure. So traditionally and alchemically speaking, the alchemical process involved taking something of earth and putting it through a series of purifications, or baptisms, as the alchemists called it, where there was a process of liquid, a process of involving air, and a process involving fire in order to release impurities from it and transform it into something that was 100 times more precious or more potent than the original substance that was being started with. So it would always go through this process of starting with earth and then going through water, air, and fire. And when this was something that the Gnostics utilized as well in their mystery rites, in order to bring people through, you know, actual baptisms of water, air, and fire, to in order to help liberate the person and bring them to what was called gnosis, or divine knowledge, or enlightenment from God. And in Freemasonry, we find this same process happening. And keep in mind, Earth usually represented just our physical association with the world. Water represented our emotional states. Air represented our mind and our intellect, and fire represented this illumination, or this light that comes through mastery. And we find this exact same pattern occurring within Freemasonry with entered apprentice degree, the penalty of the obligation is associated with water, and is also in this degree we're learning to subdue our passions or manage our emotions. Second degree is the penalty is associated with air, and this is the again related to the intellect, and of course we learn to study the seven liberal arts and sciences and things of the mind in the second degree. And third degree, the penalty of the obligations traditionally been associated with fire, and of course this is where we have to go through this new spiritual awakening where our old self dies so that we can be illuminated with the new light of understanding. Just like the Gnostics did it. And in alchemy, usually this was represented by, you know, earth represented the original herb or the substance being worked on. Water represented a digestion period in which the herb was meant to digest in a liquid that would help liberate the oils from it, or in the case of a metal, it had to go into like a liquid acid to help liberate its essence. Air was associated with distillation, in which the substance was then that was in that liquid would then be heated and turned into a gas or a steam. Or air in order to be collected in a new form. So you've separated the impurities from the pure substances, the heart and vital parts of the substance from the remaining body. And then fire involved taking the original body that was that you had leached all these hearts and vitals parts from, and calcinating it down with fire in order to get to the incorruptible salts that were hidden within it. And these incorruptible salts were said to be the purest form of the physical nature of the thing. And once you had through this process, you will have separated out any alcohol, any oils, and then these salts, which in alchemy were called the salts, the sulfur, which was the oil, and the mercury, which was the alcohol, or it was also called, the salts were called the corn, the alcohol was called the wine, and the oils were called the oil. So, you know, which we should be familiar with as Masons. And the idea was to put these things back together in a new pure form that was, you know, again, 100 times more potent and more healing than what you originally started with. So we find the same progression between earth, water, air, and fire that we also find in these early Gnostic rites, that we find in alchemy, and there's many examples of this in Kabbalah. The Kabbalistic tree is composed of a diagram representing the consciousness of God and how it manifests, arranged on three pillars designated wisdom, strength, and beauty. And going up this tree, there are three principal rungs on it, which is also called Jacob's ladder. And it has three horizontal paths. And these three horizontal paths also have traditionally been associated with water, air, and fire. And the Hebrew letters Mem, which is water, Aleph, which is air, and Sheen, which is fire, according to the principal Kabbalistic texts of the Sefer Yetzirah. So as you move up this tree towards mastery, you know, you're having to encounter this same progression of water, air, and fire. And it's a pattern that you find. And you find it in the scriptures, certainly the story of Noah's Ark, where the earth is obsessed with its physical senses. Along comes a flood or water. Then Noah lets birds go into the air. Yeah. And then he lands on Mount Ararat and makes a burnt sacrifice to God. or fire. So Jesus said, those who came before me baptized with water and spiritus, which was another name for air, I've come to baptize with fire. So there's this progression that you find repeating again and again and again and again throughout the Bible. You find it in other sacred texts as well. And it's based on this elemental progression, and it's encoded within Masonic ritual as well. So if we understand why it's encoded there, it brings greater light to what we're doing.
Yeah, heavy symbolism there. Yeah, spiritus, when Jesus saying that, spiritus, Latin spirit is to breathe. So it's yep. like, right, you know, right there, it's the air. So this is really interesting too, because earth, air, water, and fire, this is not just the Gnosticism. This is all, we also find this in like Native American, these four elements. And then of course, even in like Egyptian, the raising the Jed, there's the four levels, but we have that top level being, you know, above the three, if you will. So it's almost, it's the same kind of thing of like raising that spirit up that we, so it's just like, this is cross continents here that we find this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you find it all over the world. I mean, it's something that truly does unite. It's an esoteric doctrine that's united all over the world. Yeah. And some people think, like when Paul, the Apostle Paul said, he was taken up to the third heaven and saw Christ as a vision of light, that this is really what he was alluding to. He's talking about this third stage of initiation or awareness. In order before this could be perceived. In the Tibetan tradition, you find, I'd recommend anyone who's interested in Tibetan Buddhism and alchemy to read Lama Govinda's book, Fundamentals of Tibetan Buddhism. And all it is a book talking about these four elements and how they relate to all of the Tibetan Buddhist traditions. And how they are designed to bring about the Mani stone, you know, which is this white stone of enlightenment, you know. Yeah. And so he shows these alchemical relationships there too. And they're the same as what we find in the West.
This is just so dang interesting to me, because it really, when you see this cross culturally, what you see is that what it points to is that there is a natural, organic, like religious, you know, process within man, based on the substantiation of matter, which points directly to a science. There's really no getting around it. That this is a deep science that has been passed on. It seems to be passed on through Masonry as well.
I agree. Yeah, it's a spiritual science. You know, it's a science of transformation. You know, within ourselves and our world. I agree. There's really no other way to look at it. I mean, and to the alchemists, their science it wasn't just a physical science. It was a spiritual science. You know, to them, God was part of the equation. Everything that was being done was with the help of this consciousness stuff of God. So it was a question of how do you attune with that, and then how do you bring about transformation? And, and I would argue that most spiritual traditions, that's what their kind of utility is, when you break it right down to the bare essence, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, And I'll point out too that, you know, Masonry is not the only tradition that has, you know, this alchemical stuff. I mean, a good example is in a number of Christian traditions, they celebrate Ash Wednesday, for example. And of course, what happens in Ash Wednesday is all the palms that were supposedly laid down while the Christ was heading to Jerusalem are then burned down into ashes and then put on over the what's called the Nazar, or the brow of the person. The old Aramaic is Nazar, which is probably the origin of the word Nazarene. But that brow had a very significant meaning in a number of traditions worldwide as well. I mean, in the Eastern tradition, it's called the Anya Chakra, and it's considered the third eye, or the eye of perception. of into the true nature of things, you know. And from an alchemical standpoint, that was part of the reason of calcinating things down into ash to begin with, was to help liberate those secret salts, which could, when ingested, could help to open that that gateway of perception associated with the brow. So, you know, it's a very profound symbolism there for those who take the time to understand it. But, you know, most people have no clue what they're doing.
but I was just going to say, most people, you know, they engage in this ritual having no idea what that stuff means. I mean, and in fact, if you walked into, you know, a Catholic church or whatever nowadays and said something like this, that would be heretical.
Right.
And yet,
even though, I mean, there's no point in the Bible where Jesus is like calcinating things down and sprinkling and smudging the ashes on people's foreheads. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
That's something that was totally created by the church at some point, you know? And you find these, you know, another thing you show that shows up quite a bit are these colors, black, red, and white.
Yes.
'Cause black, you know, these were the color transformations that in alchemy things go through before it attaining their perfection, the highest perfection they can in the physical form. And so you find the same thing in, so for example, in alchemy, when you first collect an herb, you know, it starts out all green, and then as it starts to die, it turns black, blackish, right? Mm-hmm. You put it in a vessel and you put a liquid in there, like a alcohol usually, but you could also use water, and you begin to digest it. You begin to heat it, and as you do this, then the liquid begins to turn red. It begins to turn reddish, because what's happening is the oils are separating, and they then begin to get a little, not scorched, but a little heated, and as they do so, they change color and turn the liquid red. And then from there, you distill it, and during the process of distillation, what happens is, as the liquid separates from the original vessel and goes up, you know, turns into gas and then enters into a new vessel, it starts out as clear at first, and then it'll you know, as some water or whatever starts to come over, it'll turn white. Mm-hmm. So it'll be, you know, turn white at that point. So then, once you have that distillation done, you have to calcinate the original body of the herb. When you first do that, it'll turn into a black charcoal. And then from there, as it gets hotter, it'll the ash will turn redder, and of course it'll glow red as you're doing it. And then from that, you're able to extract these secret white salts. Mm-hmm. So then you're able to take those secret white salts, and through another process, it ends up going black again, and then it turns into what's called the red lion, which is said to be able to heal any part of the body. Mm-hmm. And then it can be, from there, it can turn into what's called the white eagle, which can transmute metals. So it goes black, red, white, black, red, white, black, red, white. But we find the same, and so consequently, in the Scottish Rites of Masonry, you have 32nd degree masons receive this black hat, and knight commanders of the court of honor receive a red hat, and 33rd degrees receive a white hat. And they tell you in the ritual that it's alchemical. But you also see it in, like, the Roman Catholic Church, for example. You know, the priests wear black.
Yep.
The cardinals wear red. And what does the Pope wear? White, you know?
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's a pattern that keeps reoccurring, and it's that way on purpose. It wasn't just random, you know. It's intentional.
Yeah, and speaking of red and white, I mean, we're coming up on Christmas here, and of course, red and white is attributed to Santa, and so when and of course, Christmas is the savior in the Christian religion. We find a lot of these sun god myths in different myths: Adonis, Apollo, Attis, this, you know, Mithras, Osiris, this sort of thing. And you know, I get the sense that it doesn't really matter if these personages or figures were actually real or not. It's the story itself that transcends and lasts through the ages. And you actually have a quote in your book here. It says, Christ does not need to be a person per se, but rather a state of consciousness that is achieved when the crown of the head becomes awakened. And this seems to be the central principle or core principle that is behind Christmas, because we have the sun rising again on the horizon. And so it seems to be, you know, this is what the sun god myth is all about, is really referring to your ascension process, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And we, you know, and traditionally that's been associated too with the cycles of the year, and how, you know, we've been, since the summer solstice, we've been, you know, the world's been getting darker and darker and darker as this, at least the Western Hemisphere, as the sun, you know, is around less hours of the day. And then, the Northern Hemisphere, I should say, not the Western. But, and then as we, you know, is right around the time of Christmas with the winter solstice, that's the mark when, you know, it's the darkest day of the year. So from that moment going forward, it begins to get light again, and light begins to grow more in the world, just like it symbolically does within ourselves.
And it's just, yeah, it's so interesting that here's this character, this jolly old Saint Nick that comes around wearing red and white, and then gives coal to the children that are, of course, black. And
that's,
it's
right.
Like, so here you go. You have the same elements that are playing out in Christianity, as you were saying. We see, I know the three great pyramids of Giza, from what I've been told anyway, were actually colored black, white, and red as well. So you have the same thing playing out in the Christmas, you know, Santa myth.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and the Sphinx was all painted red at one point in time. And,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. They have the beard in the London Museum of the Sphinx, and it still has some red ochre paint on it, you know, from when it was red. So, it's going back to the myths of Plato's Atlantis. You know, Plato said Atlantis was all black, red, and white too, you know. So yeah, it's one of those things that shows up again and again and again throughout history and traditions, but it always starts out, you know, the Gnostics would say it all starts out first of all as a, you know, some sort of a literal story or even as a myth, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Where it's more of a physical thing, but then as the layers are peeled off, you know, you begin to see it more of an emotional light and then an intellectual light. And to the Gnostics, the purpose of the mind and the study of the liberal arts and sciences wasn't just to prove how smart you were and do really well at Trivial Pursuit. It was to recognize that they believed that the more you studied the world, you the more you begin to recognize it's all part of one mind. It's all part of one big mind, and that there's an order to it. And so, you know, then it becomes more of a psychological, you know, metaphor, and then eventually it becomes an internal revelation.
And ultimately that revelation speaks of a death of the old self, correct?
Correct, yeah, always. You find this going back, you know, as far back as the ancient Egyptian myths, you know, when the vegetation god Osiris is chopped up and then thrown into the Nile, or thrown into the liquid, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then he gets deposited in a pillar, and Isis turns herself into a bird and flies around him, doing spells to help awaken him. And then she with the help of Sekhmet, according to some of the Egyptian texts, who's the lioness goddess, they raise him from the dead. And, you know, and now he becomes this new Osiris that transcends just the physical Osiris. And we find the same things, you know, in all these myths
Jesus dying for 3 days. For
instance. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Jesus being the most prevalent, but we certainly we find the same thing in a number of myths worldwide. And even Pythagoras was said to have raised people from the dead. So, but the you know, certainly as it relates to masonry, you know, we have this character Hiram, you know, who is going through the same transformative process. And at some point, your perceptions of your old self have to die. in order for you to become the master. Because your old self was limited by the vulnerabilities and the attachments and the the misperceptions and illusions of what you think this world is and what you know who you are in it. And at some point that has to die in order for you to be who you really are, which is an expression of this greater mind.
I was speaking with someone the other night about the kind of like, you know, the absurdity of the idea of the Great Pyramids of Giza being tombs for, you know, these dead pharaohs, you know, but if we kind of understand that in one way, if these buildings were ritualistic, you know, sites for a rebirthing process, this awakening, self-actualizing spiritual ascension process kind of thing, then the pyramids being tombs for dead pharaohs could mean, you know, in a strictly esoteric sense, that these were where the pharaohs died to their lower animal self and became, you know, recognized the God that dwells within kind of thing.
Yeah, I believe that. I absolutely believe that. And having done initiations there in the Great Pyramid, I can tell you that the way acoustically how that pyramid is built is designed in some instances to totally block out all sound. In other times to amplify it, and the only reason why you would do that is if you were utilizing it for the initiatic experience. Yeah. And so I believe they were absolutely, they were probably used for lots of different functions, but sure, one of them certainly was, I believe this, and I think that if we look at the Egyptian religion, it's very clear to me that the pharaoh was becoming the Osiris. You know, he was going through the process of Osiris. And we find this also being alluded to. And so that the mysteries of Egypt are really about this process of how do you become, you know, an expression of God or a son of God? And how do you become a, this mouthpiece for this greater thing where we're going back to the oneness. I mean, it's no mistake that, you know, Osiris is chopped up in all these pieces, which represents the separation of everything seeming separate, and then he's brought back together into the oneness and by Isis, and this is part of that transformation. And and we find the same myth, you know, being echoed in, and I point this out in Alchemical Keys to Masonic Ritual. I think I also talk about it in Entering the Chain of Union, but the, you know, in the story of Lazarus being raised from the dead.
Sure.
Lazarus in Hebrew is El Asur. El is one of the names for God. Mm-hmm. And Asur is ancient Egyptian name for Osiris. And he's raised in Bethany, which in Hebrew is Beth Anu, and Bet means house in Hebrew, and Anu was the ancient Egyptian abode of the dead. So you have Jesus raising the god Osiris in the house of the dead.
Which
so,
Anu, I think, means gear as well, doesn't it?
It does. Like, yeah, that's exactly right. Yep.
Like annual, right?
Yep, exactly. So, you know, there's a much deeper layer of meaning there, and you know, there's a number of things in the New Testament that are actually ancient Egyptian in origin, which seems to point to the fact that whether Jesus lived or not, the people who were compiling the New Testament were suggesting that these Egyptian mysteries were being brought back into the Judaic tradition that was already existing, that had come out of Egypt, and that it alluded to these mysteries of how can every person attain to this state of awakening. So it suggests that this raising of Lazarus may have actually been an initiation rite, not unlike what we experience within Freemasonry today.
And has all survived till today to remind us of this.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's pretty awesome to think about. I mean,
it is. It really is.
Yeah, there's different theories concerning the third degree in Freemasonry. Some people think it didn't really exist until 17 you know, the early 1700s, and was created by Desaguliers, who was the second Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of England, and was an alchemist, and he was good friends with Isaac Newton. My theory is that the Master Mason degree has actually always been around, but it was actually just a degree reserved for masters of lodges. And the reason why I believe this is we can find references to the master's word and the master's grip in a master taking on fellow crafts and entered apprentices going back into the 1600s. So that suggests to me that there's always been some form of master mason degree, but because it was just reserved for masters of lodges, you know, what Desaguliers did with the Grand Lodge of England is he just made it available to anybody in the craft and kind of opened it up that way. So, but it would make sense based on, you know, what we see historically. We find the same raising motif, you know, going back to the beginning.
We're about out of time here. Do you want to, I'd love to do this again, by the way. Sure. I actually got another one of your books on order here, so I'd like to get through that and maybe do this again. That'd be great. Do you want to leave the listeners with anybody? Want to tell them how to get a hold of your books or get a hold of you if they, you know, you want to lecture or anything like that?
Oh, sure. Well, first of all, I can be found very easily on Facebook. My email address is TEMERYS@yahoo.com. And as far as my books go, they're pretty much available anywhere. Most people tend to buy them off of Amazon.com. You know, my main books are Alchemical Keys to Masonic Ritual, which is about alchemy and masonry, The 32 Secret Paths of Solomon, which is about Kabbalah and masonry, and Entering the Chain of Union, which is about my meetings with different spiritual leaders around the world who predate Freemasonry, who have rituals similar to Freemasonry. Yeah, so it's a first-hand account. It's not just like reading Albert Pike saying, well, tradition says, it's about me actually traveling around and meeting with these different groups and sharing what they told me. So those are my main Masonic books. I also have a book called Revelation of the Holy Grail. It was written under a pen name of Chevalier Emerus, and that gets more into some of the Templar and Holy Grail traditions and how that came out of the Middle Ages and fed into the Renaissance and contributed in large amounts to Freemasonry in my mind. And then lastly, I have a book called Nova Clavis Esoterica, but it was a limited edition of only 555 copies, and they've already sold out. But they're, you'll find them around every once in a while. So,
any reason why that particular number?
Yeah, 555 was the number that represented the quintessence or the fifth element or the ether in alchemy. And so anytime you see it also represented initiation or the agent that transforms things. And for example, Enoch in Hebrew, every letter corresponds to a number. And so Enoch adds up to 555 when you sum all the letters in that word and in that name, and it literally means initiation is what it means. Enoch means. So,
and I believe he also lived to 365 years.
He did live to 365 years, you know, representing the course, the cycles of the cycle of days and a year and everything else. So, yeah. So, you know, 555 was one of those numbers that is the reason, in my opinion, why the Washington Monument, for example, is 555 feet high.
Absolutely.
You know, because it represents this element. So, so that's why, it was 555 copies.
Very cool. Well, you know, what I've garnered from Masonry is that, you know, man has a responsibility to one another, and, you know, that the divinity of each and every one of us comes way before any religious differences or cultural differences that we have. So I'm glad you're spreading that message. And yeah, I appreciate you coming on. It was great to speak with you. Yeah, hopefully we can do this again.
Thank you so much, brother.
All right. All the best to you.
All right.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Our outro song is called Walk on Water and is provided by Tony DePofi. Tony is an excellent singer-songwriter out of southern Wisconsin, and this song is just a beautiful, heartfelt tune full of great lyrics dealing with events in history, and a few of my good friends actually play on this track. You can check out and purchase his full-length CD entitled Dreadful News, which you can get at broadjam.com/Tony DePofi, and DePofi is spelled D-I-P-O-F-I. And you can also download this track there for free as well. Thanks for tuning in to the Marty Leeds Math Magical Radio Hour, everyone. Everyone, please have a safe and love-filled holiday. Make sure to take the time to appreciate your friends and loved ones, and have yourself a merry, jolly old good time this holiday season. Shake your belly like a bowl full of jelly, and we will see you on the flip side. Oh, and of course, don't forget, an opinion without pie is just an onion. Thanks.
You've been listening to the Marty Leeds Mathmagical Radio Hour. More information about the work of Marty Leeds can be found at MartyLeeds33.com. You can download his full-length studio record, Opus Medico Musica, from iTunes or Amazon.com. And be sure and check out his books, Pi and the English Alphabet, Volume 1 and 2, and The Peacock's Tales, available at MartyLeeds33.com and Amazon. For hours of free video, check out his YouTube channel at MartyLeeds33. More information about SyncBook Press, SyncBook Radio, or SyncBook Events can be found at thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, please support it by becoming a donor. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website and consider setting up a monthly charge. Thanks so much, and though some people think it's a piece of cake, we all know it's easy as pie.